From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Oil and blood on this fourth anniversary of the execution of Ogoni activist Ken Sarawiwa. Today we'll look at the World Bank plans to fund multinational oil giants in Chad and Cameroon. Also a discussion with Sarawiwa's brother Owens-Wiwa and Hafsat Abiola, whose father won the Nigerian presidential election but served out his term and died in prison. And a discussion on the abuse of children in Maryland's jails. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Michelle Kamdissou, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, has resigned in the middle of his third term, citing personal reasons. The move set off a behind-the-scenes struggle between the Clinton administration and European nations over who will head the agency that's dictating economic policy around the world. A newly released memo from a high-level White House staff member surmised that President Clinton could give Vice President Al Gore a boost among Puerto Rican voters by offering clemency to 16 Puerto Rican nationalists. Clinton made the offer August 11th, 5 months after the email was sent. Yesterday, Gore denied prior knowledge of the president's decision and said he had no idea whether he benefited politically from it. The March 6th note was sent by email to several White House colleagues. It noted the clemency was important to three prominent Puerto Rican lawmakers, Congressmembers Jose Serrano and Nidia Velasquez of New York and Luis Gutierrez of Illinois. All are Democrats. The Indonesian president, Abdurrahman Wahid, is facing growing opposition within his government to his support for a referendum on independence in the rest of Aceh province. One legislative leader warned a vote in the oil-rich Aceh was unconstitutional. He also said it could lead to Indonesia's breakup by inciting other provinces to demand their own referenda. In the last days, Aceh has seen the largest protests in its history, with more than a million Acehnese calling for a referendum. Indonesian military has killed thousands of people in Aceh, and the repression there continues. The Israeli government today overwhelmingly approved a troop pullback from 5% of the West Bank, ushering in the next phase of its interim land for security agreement with the Palestinians. The 7-1 vote with one abstention came just after Israeli troops evicted hundreds of Jewish settlers from a West Bank encampment that had turned into a symbol of resistance to Prime Minister Ehud Barak's land for peace deals. The eviction, coupled with the approval of the next pullback, will further improve the atmosphere as Israeli and Palestinian negotiators try to reach agreement on the broad outlines of a final peace treaty by February. Cuba is beginning a new legal campaign to fight the U.S. economic embargo, starting with a lawsuit against the U.S. government seeking more than $100 billion to compensate the Cuban people for their suffering. Ricardo Alarcón, president of Cuba's National Assembly, announced the campaign yesterday, shortly before the U.N. General Assembly voted overwhelmingly for the eighth straight year to demand that the U.S. embargo be lifted immediately. Chicago Public Schools dropped riflery training and competition from its junior ROTC program. Public Schools Chief Paul Vallas said the marksmanship curriculum could send a contradictory message to efforts to discourage the use of firearms. And this news also from Illinois. A confrontation between the Reverend Jesse Jackson and the Decatur, Illinois School Board has intensified as an attorney files a lawsuit on behalf of seven African-American students expelled for 2 years after taking part in a September 17th melee at a football game. The city's high schools were closed for a second day after Jackson rejected a board decision to cut the expulsions to 1 year. Illinois Governor George Ryan, who's just returned from Cuba, offered to waive a state law prohibiting expelled students from attending alternative schools. This news from Virginia. Five first-year Virginia Military Institute cadets have been expelled for beating a classmate. The five so-called rats, as first-year VMI students are called, entered a classmate's room around 4 a.m. Friday, restrained him, and hit him several times. The victim's face was cut and bruised. The VMI executive committee, made up of officers from the three upper classes, heard evidence Monday and recommended the five cadets be expelled. During their first 6 months at VMI, cadets are pushed physically and mentally and constantly hounded by upperclassmen as part of a process of instilling discipline. Physical abuse is forbidden. There's a dangerous new email virus to worry about. It can destroy information on computers even when users are careful not to fully open the messages. The virus is nicknamed Bubble Boy after an episode of the TV show Seinfeld. It's been emailed to Network Associates, a computer security company near San Francisco. The company has put a free software patch capable of blocking the attack on its website. Network Associates isn't certain who sent the virus, but researchers believe its threat is so serious they've notified the FBI. The virus affects computers with Windows 98 and some versions of Windows 95 that also use Microsoft's Internet Explorer 5.0 and Outlook Express web browser and email programs.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie, not gonna go unless you tell him to go. Zombie, not gonna stop unless you tell him to stop.
Zombie,
zombie, not gonna turn unless you tell him to turn.
Zombie,
zombie, not gonna think unless you tell him to think.
Zombie,
zombie, oh zombie.
Zombie,
zombie, oh zombie.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners. And as the presidential season is heating up, I understand now that we're getting the reports that Donald Trump, the clown prince of the billionaire candidates expected next year, is proposing a 14% tax the rich program to save the Social Security and the federal budget. Of course, deep in the fine print is that he's also recommending an elimination of the 50% inheritance tax for most people. So that would mean that actually he would end up gaining in the process 14% versus 50% that he would save in the long run in his estate.
Well, that's interesting you should mention gaining, Juan, because the Senate has approved a Republican bill raising the minimum wage $1 over 3 years, but they've also approved a companion measure cutting small business taxes by $18.4 billion over 5 years. The Democrats had fought this, wanted only half of that, but the Republicans won.
Sounds more like street corner shell games.
Well, it doesn't look like President Clinton is going to sign off on that bill. But also talking about presidential politics, moving from George W. Bush in Texas to Florida, Jeb Bush, the Florida governor, has just rescinded affirmative action in the state. A very significant is Ward Connerly, the California businessman, promised to come to Florida to push a petition drive to eliminate Florida's affirmative action programs. Jeb Bush has signed an order that eliminates race and ethnicity as factors in university admissions and in contracting decisions, which essentially ends affirmative action in state programs. Very significant. And interesting, you should mention Shell, Juan, because we're going to be talking about Shell in just a little while. We're going to be talking about a massive multi-billion dollar oil pipeline called the Chad Cameroon Project. And it looks like Shell and Elf Aquitaine, large oil multinationals, have just announced that they are going to pull out of it. But we're going to talk about its significance because Exxon and the World Bank promised that they will support it. But right now, first, we're going to California to look at a case that we have been following for a number of weeks now. Four Corcoran State prison guards were just acquitted this week of setting up the March 1993 rape of a prisoner, a verdict that was immediately praised by the Prison Guards Union and condemned by prisoners' rights advocates. The officers, Robert Decker, Joe Sanchez, Anthony Silva, and Dale Brakebill, were found not guilty of setting up the rape of Eddie Dillard when they put him in a cell with a known sexual predator who was nearly twice his size. Wayne Robertson was the predator's name. He was known by the nickname the Booty Bandit. He raped Dillard repeatedly after the guards left Dillard in a cell for 2 days. The incident took place at one of the most notoriously violent prisons in the country. It was a 5-week trial, the first criminal trial of Corcoran guards in a decade, and it included the testimony of both the prisoner who was raped, Eddie Dillard, and Wayne Robertson, the rapist, who himself admitted what he did, as well as a whistleblowing guard who participated in the brutal incident. Nevertheless, the jury acquitted the guards. The stakes were high, not only for the guards, but also for the guards' union and the Attorney General's office, which was criticized in legislative hearings last year for ignoring numerous incidents of brutality at Corcoran. We're joined right now by Catherine Campbell, who is the president of California Prison Focus and has been following this case very closely. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Catherine.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, can you tell us what were the grounds for the acquittal of these four guards, and were you surprised?
No one was surprised. All of us who had been watching the trial on a regular basis could see the prosecution case slowly unravel as the days went by. So the jury verdict was anticipated. The defendant's position was that they did not know that Wayne Robertson was a sexual predator, something that is impossible to believe if you're aware of the culture of the security housing unit at Corcoran, but no officers were willing to come forward and testify that as to Wayne Robertson's reputation.
Well, Catherine, we interviewed Tom Quinn on Friday, and he also indicated that he thought there was going to be an acquittal. What does impact will this have on the upcoming trials in March for those guards accused in the infamous turkey shoots at Corcoran?
That would be the Tate case, and it is set for trial in March, and it's in a different context slightly, which is that it's in federal district court, which has a wider, broader jury pool, and that will make some difference. Hopefully it's going to mobilize the prosecution in that case, which I believe is likely to bring more moral authority to that prosecution than was brought to this one. But it's going to have overall a negative effect. It's going to embolden the prison guards union. It's going to strengthen the defense attorneys in that case. It's going to give credence to those who say that these prosecutions are part of a witch hunt.
And is the same whistleblowing correction officer expected to be a witness in that case as well?
No, Pondexter was a witness to the Booty Bandit situation, but he was not a witness to the Tate killing.
Now, in this case, actually, you represent the Tate family. Is that right? Just briefly explain.
I represented them in the civil suit, yes, which was settled approximately a year ago.
And explain what this next trial will involve, what the turkey shoot is.
The officers are charged with civil rights violations resulting in death. There were four officers who gathered together in a control booth above the yard, which is approximately the size of a handball court. They are accused of knowing in advance that a fight was going to occur and having arranged that fight between Latino and black inmates, sending those inmates to the yard, watching them fight, and then shooting one of them, Preston Tate, and killing him with a shot to the head.
Well, last comments on this trial this week that ended finding the prison guards innocent.
Unfortunately, the California Correctional Peace Officers Association is going to be strengthened by this verdict, politically and in other ways. And I think that's very unfortunate for the political climate of California.
Catherine Campbell, thanks for being with us. Catherine
You're
Campbell
welcome.
Is an attorney in Fresno and president of the California Prison Focus Organization. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we move on to another issue of criminal justice. Human Rights Watch has just released a report charging that hundreds of children are being held in appalling conditions in the Baltimore City Detention Center and other adult jails around Maryland. The detention centers around the state, according to the report, lack adequate education, medical care, mental health programs, and in smaller facilities, children are incarcerated with adults while they await trial. The report is close to 170 pages. It's called No Minor Matter, Children in Maryland Jails. And it found that the worst conditions are in the Baltimore City Detention Center. We're joined right now by Joe Becker, who is the Children's Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Joe.
Thanks. Good morning.
Good to be with you. Tell us about what you found.
We looked at the state of Maryland because there are actually 40 states across the country that have passed laws in the last 7 or 8 years that have made it easier to put juveniles into the adult criminal justice system. And as a result, kids are being held in adult jails. What we found, simply put, is that these jails are no place for kids. They don't have the programs, they don't have the staffing, they don't have the infrastructure to handle juveniles. In one jail that we looked at, we found that kids were getting no education whatsoever, even though many of them were kept for as long as 6 to 9 months before trial. And certainly the worst conditions were in the Baltimore City Jail. Cells are grim. They're infested with cockroaches, rats, mice. They're hot in the summer, cold in the wintertime. This facility is rampant with violence. There are homemade weapons that are easily accessible by detainees, and stabbings are not uncommon.
Now, Joe, I understand that there's been an ongoing battle in Congress over this the juvenile justice bill that would basically remove all barriers to housing juveniles with adults. So in Maryland, this has been the practice now for how long?
There was one law that was passed in 1994. Making a whole class of crimes such that juveniles who commit those crimes or would be charged with those crimes are automatically sent to the adult system. And then additional legislation was passed in 1997. What fuels this is there's a public perception that juvenile crime is out of control. And by putting juveniles into the adult criminal system, it's a way of deterring juvenile crime. But first of all, juvenile crime has actually dropped every year since 1993. So the perception is wrong. And then secondly, studies have found that putting kids into the adult system is not going to prevent future crime.
Joe Becker, what would you say to those who would say the reason the juvenile crime has dropped is precisely because they're put in these draconian situations?
Studies show otherwise. They show that kids who are kept in adult jails are more likely to commit crimes after they're released than kids who are put into juvenile detention centers.
Why?
Partly, they're not getting the rehabilitation programs, they're not getting counseling, and they're exposed to adult repeat offenders. There was one kid in the Montgomery County Jail who we talked to who said, you know, putting me in an adult jail, it's not rehabilitating me, it's just teaching me how to be a better criminal.
Of course, when you say the public perception that juvenile crime is out of control, I mean, there have been obviously the high-profile incidents like Columbine and others, but as I understand it, there was one study of the network news that showed that there was between 93 and 96 something like a 700% increase in the amount of time devoted on network news to crime, so that actually the public's perception of the crime problem versus the reality is at odds not just with juveniles, but with adults as well.
That's correct.
And what's been the reaction so far to the release of the report?
Local advocates who work on juvenile justice issues are thrilled to have, you know, evidence that backs up the claims that they've been making all along, that juveniles in the state aren't being treated well, that they need better rehabilitation programs, and that they don't belong in adult jails. On the other hand, jail officials are denying a lot of our charges. They're saying that they are based on uncorroborated interviews with juveniles. But we interviewed more than 60 juveniles for this study, and we feel confident that our results are solid.
What are you recommending?
We're recommending that the state of Maryland change its laws to no longer make it automatic that juveniles charged with certain crimes would automatically go into the adult criminal justice system. We think that that should only happen in extreme cases and only at the discretion of a judge.
And what are the prospects for being able to get any of those recommendations passed right now?
There's been a commission that's been set up by the Maryland State Legislature to look at the whole issue of the jurisdiction of juvenile crimes. The political climate, though, is not that hopeful. I think the trend towards getting tough and passing more and more draconian measures is still moving forward. We're hoping to counter that.
If people want to get a hold of the report, where can they go?
They can call Human Rights Watch at 212-216-1236.
One more time.
212-216-1236.
We want to thank you very much for being with us. Jo Becker, she is the Children's Rights Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch. The report is called No Minor Matter, Children in Maryland Jails. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Today, November 10th, marks the fourth anniversary of the execution of Ken Sarawiwa and eight other Ogoni activists who were hanged in 1995 by the Nigerian military. The men were protesting the environmental devastation caused by Royal Dutch Shell in the Ogoniland region of Nigeria in the Niger Delta, and the multinational oil giant's involvement in human rights abuses of Nigeria's brutal military regime under Sani Abacha. Human rights advocates around the world criticize Shell Oil for failing to come to the aid of the nine activists in an attempt to save their lives. And many believe that they were working with the Nigerian military to go after Ken Sarawiwa and his allies. Human rights and environmental groups around the world are holding demonstrations today commemorating the life and deaths of Sarawiwa and the other activists. In Washington, there'll be a rally and memorial procession in front of Shell Oil's headquarters in San Francisco, a similar rally in Vancouver. Activists are remembering Sarawiwa as they enter the fifth year of their boycott against Shell. First, we're going to go to an interview that I got a chance to do with Ken Sarawiwa, along with my colleague Bernard White of Pacifica Station WBAI. It was a year before he was executed. Ken Sarawiwa came to the United States and talked about his fear of being killed, but talked mostly about his fight for human rights and for his people in Ogoniland. This is Ken Sarawiwa.
And Shell does not want to negotiate with the Ogoni people. Each time they've come under pressure from local people, their want has always been to run to the Nigerian government and to say to the Nigerian government, oil is 90% of your foreign exchange earning. If anything happens to oil, your economy will be destroyed. Therefore, you must go and deal with these people, these troublemakers. And most times, the government would oblige them and visit local communities, poor, dispossessed people with a lot of violence. And when these communities then protested and said, look at the amount of violence that is being used against us, even though we are only protesting peacefully, then the oil companies will come and say, well, there is no way we can determine how much violence a government decides to use against its own people. So basically, the local communities have no leverage with the oil companies at all.
Who is the government now of Nigeria?
There is a military government in power at this time, and indeed military people have been in power in the country for a long time.
Because they suspended the results of the elections?
Yes, indeed. But for a long time now, Nigeria has been under military dictatorships, and the oil companies like military dictatorships because basically they can treat with these dictatorships. The dictatorships are brutal to people, and they can deny the rights of human rights of individuals and of communities quite easily without compunction.
Ken Sarawewa, how does the oil companies, how do Shell and Chevron deal with you as the president of the Movement for the Survival of the Ogoni People?
Well, recently, when the protest started, the Shell, they had a meeting, operatives of Shell in Nigeria and of those at The Hague in the Netherlands and in London held a meeting, and they decided that they would have to keep an eye on me, watch wherever I go to, follow me constantly to ensure that I do not embarrass Shell. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm a marked man where Shell are concerned, and indeed I have been in detention in Nigeria several times. My passport has been impounded. The last time round, in the middle of June, I was held for 31 days without charge, and eventually
The Nigerian government
held me, shunted me from prison to prison, and it's only international concern that allowed them to send me on bail. Early this year, on the 2nd of January to be precise, I was placed under house arrest with my entire family for 3 days in order to stop a planned protest against Shell. 300,000 Ogoni people were going to move to protest the devastation of the environment by Shell and the other multinational oil companies. And it was in the interest of these companies to ensure that I was not, that this demonstration did not hold. And all they did was simply send the military authorities to my house. They disconnected my telephones, confiscated the handsets, and I was held for 3 days without food.
In fact, even before then, not only himself, almost all the leaders of the movement have always been harassed. In fact, before his own ordeal, the recent ordeal he mentioned about, myself and his younger brother, Dr. Onwiwa, were picked up about 2 a.m. and locked up in detention. We spent 9 days for no charge had been preferred for that. They just put us in, according to them, to make sure that the anniversary of the Ogoni people for the protest do not take place.
What was detention like? I mean, what did...
Oh, it's horrible. We are thrown into a place, into a room without beds, without carpet, the toilets were not there. In fact, we were not fed until for about, out of the 9 days, we were fed only about 2 days. And even the doctor was sick. He complained that he needed medical attention. No one bothered to talk to him. It was a very horrible experience we had.
And what does the Nigerian government say in explaining why they detain you?
Well, all they say is that they don't want the Ogoni people. You see, they feel that we've got so much courage, I mean, for daring to have the courage to challenge the multinational and the government, then at least the leaders should be put away for some time.
So there's no pretense then? They are saying it's because of your leadership in the Ogoni people's movement?
No, not at all. They actually say that because of the leadership of the Ogoni movement. That's exactly what they are doing.
Ken Saro-Wiwa
and Letta Mettig are the two people that we interviewed 5 years ago. Letta Mettig, also a leader of MOSAP, who continues to be, was tried and acquitted. MOSAP is the movement for the survival of the Ogoni people. But Ken Saro-Wiwa, the last voice you just heard, was executed along with eight other human rights Ogoni activists on November 10th, 1995. We're joined right now by Hafsat Abiola, who is a 24-year-old human rights activist. Her father, Mashood Abiola, won Nigeria's presidential election in 1993, but he was immediately imprisoned by Sani Abacha, the dictator who seized power, and Mashood Abiola died in prison on the eve of his release. Hafsat's mother, Kudirat, was a pro-democracy leader as well and was assassinated on the streets of Lagos, Nigeria in 1996. Hafsat, forced into exile, now resides in Washington, D.C., and runs the Kudirat Institute for Democracy, which promotes the development of women and youth. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Hafsat. Well, it's good to be with you. I know you just returned from Canada, where you were with Ken Saro-Wiwa's brother, Dr. Owens Wiwa, remembering Ken Saro-Wiwa. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking about the Chad-Cameroon oil pipeline and the kinds of concerns that are being raised there that are similar to concerns that Ken Saro-Wiwa raised in the Niger Delta. But what are your thoughts on this day?
I'm just deeply sad. And I was happy to be able to go to Canada and be with Ken Saro-Wiwa's son and brother and just be with them because, as you can well imagine, I very much understand what they're going through because I lost both my parents in this in Nigeria's pro-democracy struggle. At the same time, when I was in Nigeria, I went to Nigeria for the summer, I also went to Ogoni land and met with Ken's father and mom and with these people. I met with over 1,000 people in a church where they'd come to meet with me and talk to me about what they'd gone through in the period under military rule. And I'm just hopeful that things will turn around for them, that even though they're a minority ethnic group in Nigeria, the rest of the country will be so deeply ashamed of what they've had to undergo that much reform will be put in place that will change their lives because they keep appealing for that and it hasn't been done, it hasn't happened yet. So the struggle really does continue for them.
Well, Hafsat, what about the changes that you saw in Nigeria on your recent visit? Do you see that there is really a marked movement toward democracy, or something else?
I think there's a movement towards democracy. When I was in Nigeria, I went to 10 states of our country's 36 states, and it was just me and seven other women. We would charter a bus and just drive. We're never hassled by the police or soldiers, which is unique because in the past, Nigerian citizens were harassed all the time by our security forces. We had no problems at all, and that's a big change from the past. There's talk of retraining the military and the police force, which needs to happen because they've been trained to oppress the people of Nigeria. They now have to be trained to protect and guard them. But when I went to Ogoni land, they continue to have the problems of oil pollution. Indeed, when I went to visit, 2 days prior to my visit, there had just been another oil spill in Ogoni land. There was also gas flares, which I saw. They took me to see some of the pollution. So there are those problems still. And the government, I do not believe that the government is taking the right approach to resolving this because the government is taking a top-down approach. But the Ogoni people have a Bill of Rights that was done by the people of Ogoni land. And they've shared that knowledge of how you do that with other ethnic minorities. So there's a popular movement in Ogoni land and the surrounding ethnic minorities for power to the people. A top-down approach can't work and won't be credible in a situation like that. The government really does need to meet with the people of Ogoni, their leadership from their popular movement, environmental movement, MOSAP. And the government has not really done that in a way that shows the awareness of the depth of the crisis.
Kudirat Abiola was your mother. And today, Hafsat Abiola, you are honoring women. You're looking at development and globalization at an international conference that's taking place in Washington, D.C., that's sponsored by the Association for Women in Development. Can you talk about your Nigerian perspective on this, how Nigeria fits into the overall picture of globalization as we move into our segment on this massive oil pipeline that Exxon is going to be leading in Chad, Cameroon, that it looks like Shell and Alf Aquitaine have just pulled out of in the last few hours?
Well, like most developing countries, and the Nigerian government has been really, I think, attracted by the big money that the oil companies bring. But the way to development is really by empowering the people of Nigeria, common people in Nigeria, so that they can be engaged in markets and develop their own local industry and their domestic economy. Much of domestic economies in Nigeria is pioneered by women. Over 60% of agriculture is run by women. Women are the farmers, the rural farmers in Nigeria. They're also the ones in the small markets that trade in small ways. But many times there's very little investment by the government in helping them rise to scale and to help promote their exportation of their crops or their farming or their products. That needs to change because, as we've seen, when the government gets its money only from the military and from the oil companies, it doesn't feel really accountable to the people of Nigeria. It feels accountable instead to the oil interests, which allows it to have very disastrous policies that completely undermine economic growth and progress in Nigeria. So we're really needing to have, a shift from that kind of policy, a commitment to oil companies and huge multinationals, to a commitment to common people of Nigeria. This conference that's taking place in Washington, D.C. is going to bring about 1,500 women that work on development issues from over 100 countries. And the whole point of this is how do we leverage the policymakers and all the powerful people coming to this conference in support of and on behalf of development in developing countries around the world and even in developed countries in such a way that power does come to the people, economic power and social and political power is returned to the people, common people in our world. So it's really exciting, this conference. It's from the 11th to the 14th in Washington, D.C. It's with AWID, Association for Women in Development. So we Nigerian women that are going to be there are really looking forward to what we're going to learn, technologies and best practices to help us in our work in Nigeria.
And Hafsat Abiola, since the elections and the end of military rule there, has there been a return migration of those Nigerians who had left the country and fled because of the dictatorship to return and attempt to assist in the development of the popular movement?
Certainly. I mean, already so many Nigerians in exile have been going home to visit and to see what they can contribute. I think that to support something like that happening, a mass return of Nigerians, we need to have structural changes in the country. And these structural changes would also help oil minorities. The key thing that Nigerian pro-democracy people are asking for is a gathering of the ethnic nationalities that make up Nigeria to look at how we as a country will run. Instead of always being dependent on the goodwill of the person that runs the country, and right now we have President Obasanjo who seems reasonable, but why must we always be dependent on the person running the country and not dependent on our constitution that is popularly developed? So what we're asking for is a chance for all people of Nigeria to look and develop a constitution that serves us and honors who we are as peoples. And I think that that's exactly what the ethnic minorities like the Ogoni people would also need. Because in that kind of gathering, they can present their case of resource depletion and environmental devastation and demand a resource allocation process and a relationship with the oil companies that will will help preserve their lands and their waters. So really, that's what we all need for Nigerians to feel safe in Nigeria again.
Hafsat Abiola, I want to thank you very much for being with us. If people want to get in touch with the Kudirat Institute for Democracy that you run, promoting the development of women and youth, where can they call or go on the web?
Our web address is www.igc.org/kind. And our telephone number is 301-883-0169.
The phone number again?
301-883-0169.
Thank you.
Amy, thank you for all the work you're doing for Nigeria and places like that. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Hafsat Abiola, human rights activist and organizer. Her mother killed on the streets of Lagos, believed by the Nigerian military. Her father, Mashuda Abiola, believed to have won the presidential election of 93, but imprisoned by the military dictator, Sani Abacha, and died in prison. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, we look at 1999 in Chad and Cameroon and a massive multi-billion-dollar oil pipeline. In the last hours, some major developments around that, and we'll find out why environmental activists around the world are concerned. We'll also speak with the World Bank. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Well, now, the environmental and human rights communities fear that another Ogoniland could be created in two of the world's poorest nations, which are also in Africa, Chad and Cameroon. The World Bank is about to underwrite the activities of multinational oil companies operating in these two countries. The latest news we have is that Shell and French-owned Elf Aquitaine have just pulled out of a massive oil pipeline project that Exxon is going to be the operator of. Government officials in both Chad and Cameroon say the project is key to the region's economic development. Critics say otherwise, that they're concerned about human rights abuses already in Chad, including killings by paramilitary death squads. We are now going to be joined by two people to talk about this issue. One is from the World Bank. One is an environmentalist and economist from the Environmental Defense Fund. Corinna Horta joins us from Washington. And we're joined by Robert Calderisi, who's a spokesperson for the World Bank. Why don't we start with the World Bank? Robert Calderisi, welcome to Democracy Now! And can you start off by describing what this project is and also this latest news that Shell and Elf Aquitaine have pulled out?
Well, the project has been under intense discussion over the last 3 years, but in fact, Chad has been waiting almost 30 years for oil to be developed. The fields were discovered in 1969, and it's as one of the poorest countries in the world with almost no other options for development. They're very keen on developing this oil, and the project would actually fund a 600-mile pipeline, which would be buried from the oil fields in southern Chad to the Atlantic coast of Cameroon. On the financial composition of the consortium funding the project, I mean, these are new developments, and I'm afraid I can't really speak for the companies involved, but clearly there'll be some efforts to fix the financing over the next while. It's not necessarily a permanent problem, but obviously it's an issue which is fairly important and occurred rather suddenly.
I will say we tried to get Shell on, but they would not comment either on the project or on their withdrawal from the project.
Mr. Calderisi, is this an unusual project for the World Bank, the subsidizing of an oil pipeline? Wouldn't this normally be a part of the actual capital expenditures of any oil company that is seeking to make a profit from the line?
Yeah, we're not actually subsidizing anybody. We would be lending a small amount of the total financing to the two governments, Chad and Cameroon, to finance their shareholding in the two pipeline companies. This would ensure that the revenues coming to the two governments would be higher than they otherwise would be, and also they have a say in the management of the pipeline companies. We're not even using money which you would usually use for Africa, that is interest-free money. We're actually lending them our own borrowed funds.
And how much is that?
About $90 million divided between the two governments. It's less than 5% of the total cost of the project, which would be about $3.5 billion. And our only involvement in the project has really been to deal with the concerns that most observers of this project have been commenting on for a while, including international non-government organizations. That is, to make certain that the impact of the environment would be minimal. And secondly, to ensure that the oil revenues that would be produced would be used for the benefit of people in Chad and Cameroon.
Corinna Horta of the Environmental Defense Fund, what is your concern about this project?
Our concern about this project is a little bit along the line of what Hafsat Abiola said. The important thing is to have local people empowered to defend themselves against the huge environmental risks of this project. And the environmental risks in this project do not stand by themselves. They have to be understood in the context of the political situation in both Chad and Cameroon. And what you have is two dictatorships where people's rights are not being respected, where the violation of human rights is commonplace. A country like Chad, which has just emerged out of a 30-year-long, very brutal civil war situation, is a country where the elites of the country are used in solving problems by violent means. It's a very, very dangerous situation. And basically, the civil society organizations in Chad and supported by organizations in Cameroon are calling for a moratorium on a final decision of the project. They are not against the project per se because the countries are poor and, in theory, oil income could benefit local communities, could bring things that they wish, like, you know, schools, dispensaries, hospitals, roads, and all these sorts of things. Only they are convinced that under present circumstances, there will be no benefits of the project for local people and for the populations overall in the countries concerned, that to the contrary, there could be, you know, massive impoverishment as a result of the project. Let me just add to Mr. Calderisi's statement that the World Bank was only contributing $90 million to the project, less than 5% of total project cost. In addition to the World Bank lending window that he is referring to, there is the private sector branch of the World Bank, the International Finance Corporation, which is providing over or plans to provide over $150 million to this project. But more importantly, it has committed itself to help raise hundreds of millions of additional dollars on private capital markets for this project. So World Bank involvement is quite more than just in the number that was just given to us. In addition, of course, World Bank funding serves kind of as the gateway for other financial institutions to contribute to this project. Other financial institutions will feel reassured with World Bank approval of this project and thereby commit their own funding resources to it. One example would be the U.S. Exim Bank, but also the export credit agencies of a number of European countries would immediately contribute to this project once the World Bank has approved it.
Mr. Calderisi, what about those points of Corinna Horta?
Yeah, Ms. Horta is right. I should have mentioned the proposed contribution of our private sector wing of the bank group. It would still be, though, our total contribution would still be less than 5% of total costs. On the project itself, I mean, I was in Chad in Cameroon just the week before last with a bank team, and we met with the non-government organizations in Cameroon and in Chad, including in the project area itself. And there's a tremendous variety of opinion within the community about whether the project should go ahead quickly or not. In fact, what to me was most significant was that in both countries, the non-government organizations were very positive about the role of the World Bank, because from their point of view, it had allowed a public debate and consultations which otherwise might not have taken place. They also acknowledged that the environmental management plan was much, much better than the first draft had been 2 years ago as a result of World Bank involvement. And I would add, as a result of the advice of community groups in Chad and Cameroon and elsewhere, including the Environmental Defense Fund in the United States. This public debate has been going on for a long time. It's been also been very productive. They were also quite positive about the oil revenue management schemes which have been proposed, which would ensure that 80% of the oil funds in Chad would be used for basic health and education, environmental spending, rural roads, and things that would help people directly. The issue remains, and on that it's really a matter of judgment, is just how, are there any guarantees that these agreements would be respected in Chad? And on that, the judgment is very much one of whether one can walk away and write off a project which could transform the economy and society of one of the poorest countries in the world, or else stick with it and do everything we can, but more importantly, have Chadians and Cameroonians do everything they can to ensure that the government live up to their agreements. And they're not going to be doing this in isolation. The agreements are such, the management of the oil accounts would be such that they'd be working within a glass bowl on this. There'd be quite a lot of public attention paid to this. On the political situation of the two countries, they're not ones which Americans or Canadians like myself would be comfortable living in. But I think we also have to acknowledge real progress. As Ms. Hort has said, Chad has had a terrible history. It was through civil war for 30 of its 40 years of independence. But over the last 10 years, there have been real efforts to build a more inclusive and open government. It's not yet at the standards that one would want, but then there are very few countries in Africa which are at a stage of development of democracy that would be appreciated here in the United States. But in the last 4 years, the government currently in office, which, by the way, was elected, it's the first elected parliament and the first elected president in the history of the country. They've made real progress in areas which we think important. They've cut the size of the army in half. They're already devoting 70% of public revenues to things which we consider important for development, which is a good indication that they're likely to use the new revenues properly as well.
Robert Calderisi, I just want to interrupt because we only have a few more minutes of the show, and we do have one more person on. Mr. Calderisi is spokesperson for the World Bank, Corinna Horta, economist at the Environmental Defense Fund, and Eric Brownstein with us now, Africa Campaign Director for the Rainforest Action Network. Are you encouraged by what Mr. Calderisi is saying, Eric Brownstein?
Hi, Amy. Thanks. In fact, I would have to say no, that I'm not encouraged overall. I'm encouraged by the personal concern, of course, that I hear in his voice, but I'm not very encouraged by the World Bank's continued insistence on the kind of top-down approach that this kind of project represents, and the sort of characterization of the state of these countries in which this project in particular is associated. I was just looking over some of my notes and reading excerpts from the 1999 U.S. State Department report on Chad, where they say things like members of the security forces tortured, beat, abused, and raped citizens. As in previous years, the government took no action to prosecute members of the security forces, and so on. And so when I hear this kind of support for a project like this, I'm actually quite disheartened, and kind of have to maintain this sense of optimism that an institution like the World Bank can actually start to reassess their vision of development and hopefully see that it becomes more in line with the kind of development that we heard Ms. Abiola mentioning, a more of a locally derived economic approach, things that are based on sort of the empowerment of local communities, especially as characterized by the kind of objectives set out by women.
So what is the campaign that you have organized at Rainforest Action Network around the Chad Cameron pipeline?
The campaign that we've been working on at Rainforest Action Network has been to bring attention to the one person at the World Bank who we feel really has the power to make the right decision. The president of the World Bank, James Wolfensohn, has spoken out considerably about his and the World Bank's commitment to poverty reduction and sustainable development, and has spoken about corruption being the main impediment to that. And as we know, Cameroon just this year recently was rated the world's most corrupt government now for the second year in a row. And the government of Chad, as I've just mentioned, is quite notorious for their human rights abuses. So our campaign has been to call to accountability this institution based in the United States, the World Bank, and more specifically to call to accountability the president of that institution, asking him to live up to his words and take a stand and see that this project actually can meet the kind of objectives that he's proposing.
Mr. Calderisi, I'd like to ask you, in terms of this whole issue of the imperative to try to make to have development and not lose this opportunity for the economic benefit of the people of Chad and Cameroon. We've had many examples around the world of countries, like Venezuela, for example, with huge yes. oil reserves, but somehow when they were developed, this wealth never trickled down to the vast majority of the Venezuelan people. What makes you think that the situation here in Chad and Cameroon would be any different?
Well, history is very discouraging on this. Natural resource booms are difficult to manage, and the positive cases in the world are rather few. And one of the purposes of our being involved is to bring some of those lessons to bear on this project. Botswana in Africa managed its mineral resources very well over since independence. It's had the fastest economic growth of any developing country in the last 30 years, and its government has been extremely participatory and focus these resources on programs helping the people of Botswana. I also worked for almost 10 years on Indonesia, which of course has a reputation more recently of mismanagement and corruption, but people tend to forget that Indonesia managed a tremendous increase in oil wealth in the early 70s and for 15 years in a way which enabled them to reduce the number of poor people in the country from 60% of the population to under 20% of the population.
It's interesting you should raise the issue. I mean, when you're working there also, there's the massive number of human rights abuses. And just in this last week in Aceh, where they're
yes.
finding what the biggest gas reserves in the world, where
yes.
Mobil has been mm-hmm. working, you have a million people who are protesting against those human rights abuses. I just wanted to end, though.
Well, they're demonstrating for autonomy or independence.
And
of course,
because of
a
the
very
repression.
Terrible couple of years of military repression against the independence movement. But again,
let me just throw this out because yes. we want to end on the Chad Cameroon mm-hmm. pipeline, and that is the protest that Rainforest Action Network is waging. And I want to know the kind of effect it's having on the World Bank, though we just have 30 seconds. Eric Brownstein, the ad campaign?
The ad campaign was something that was meant to call, once again, attention to this special role that President of the World Bank, Wolfensohn, can play in this project to see that, the negative consequences will not become realized. In no way was it an attack against Mr. Wolfensohn, as it was often characterized. Rather, it was a call to accountability, asking him to show real leadership and stand up for his words.
Well, on that note, we have to wrap up this discussion. Our guests have been World Bank spokesperson Robert Calderisi, Corinna Huerta, economist at the Environmental Defense Fund, Eric Brownstein of the Rainforest Action Network. And that does it for today's program, Democracy Now!, produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. If you'd like to order a cassette of today's show, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez from the studios of WBAI in New York for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!